KUFF San Francisco.
I kid you not, I was writing notes up until 2 seconds ago of how to intro this first hour of Just Another Menace Sunday. Hi, it's Dennis the Menace. How are you? How's your Sunday going? Well, Michael Penn and I, let's just start right there. Let's start with the connections. Michael Penn and I are, a year apart in age. him born in 1958. I'll let you figure out which side of the fence I'm on there. Of course, you know, he comes from a pretty famous family. His dad, Arthur Penn, famous director. His brother, a guy named Sean Penn. And the history gets even more fun. Michael Houseman, who is his manager and the co-founder of United Musicians, was the girlfriend of Amy Mann of Till Tuesday, who I interviewed back on their very, very first foray into music with Voices Carry, back when I was in Boston. Well, of course, Michael Penn, ended up marrying Amy Mann, as I'm sure you know, who was just here last Friday night. And of course, I discovered Michael Penn, as most people did, when he had No Myth out in the late 80s. Was it the late 80s? Oh, I'm not going to go back and get the CD now. You know I'll check it out later. And today, Michael Penn does soundtracks with Paul Thomas Anderson, appears at Largo with John Bryan and that whole gang, and of course with Amy, and is this wonderful, wonderful musician who I think is coming back. In fact, he will be back at Café du Nord within seconds. And what's even, well, most interesting to me is the fact that the interview I did with Michael was in anticipation of this album, Mr. Hollywood Jr., 1947. And I did the interview back at South by Southwest, not last March, but the March before this, so a year and a half ago. And he was talking about the record then. Had to get out of all sorts of record company insanity, find a new one. He did. Very interesting independent label called Spin Art out of New York. And Mr. Hollywood Jr., 1947, we've had it for a long time. We've been sharing it with you for 6 months. If you are indeed a Michael Penn fan, or even if you're not, the record is finally out pretty much this week in record stores near you. So let's go back a year and a half ago, although you won't know it was a year and a half ago, because he's talking about the record like it came out today. It's Michael Penn, our first hour interview here on Just Another Menace Sunday. So what's I know what's new and exciting, but tell me a little bit. Give me the fill in the blanks between MP4 and now.
Let's see.
There's a lot of them, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's a few. They're all fairly large chunklets. So the first chunklet would be essentially a nervous breakdown, but we won't go into that one. I did a score for an independent movie directed by a guy named Bob Odenkirk, who was the Bob of Bob and David of Mr. Show on HBO.
Right.
And Bob made a film called Melvin Goes to Dinner, which
I saw. I saw it at Sundance. Incredible film.
It actually won the South by Southwest Festival last year.
Cool.
And it's a really wonderful little film, and it's based on a play written by a guy named Michael Blyden called Fire Giants, and it's just an unusual movie, especially these days, because it's all about dialogue and it's all about the depth of these characters, and they're just sort of all interacting at this dinner. And it's just a really lovely movie, and so that was a good chunk of time. And then I produced an album for Liz Phair, which never actually wound up coming out.
This was the pre-current. Yeah.
Some of the stuff, I think five tracks that we had done together are on it, but the album itself was sort of a piece. So my disappointment is more that the sort of the breadth of material that we had done together didn't get released. So that's a kind of a drag. But those are sort of the two main things between MP4 and now.
So let's talk about the composing for film, because you've also with I guess everybody now calls him PTA, which still sounds like something that parents go to school for.
Yes.
But
well, I think he actually credits himself as P.T. Anderson in the style of P.T. Barnum,
right,
which makes far more sense than a PTA meeting.
Well, it's kind of scary. I feel it's kind of that, you know, I hate this whole 6 degrees thing, but I worked a lot with his dad, Ernie Anderson,
because
I run an ad agency when I don't do this. So I did a ton of work with Ernie, and Ernie was, the most amazing character. He would not go in the booth. He stood behind, you had to put the microphone behind the control board so he could watch the levels of his voice.
Well, I think Paul's inherited the control freak aspect of that.
That's what I was going. Yeah. I was kind of going there. So what's it like? Tell the audience a little bit, for those who might not, you know, kind of know the other side of things, about the films you worked on with them and what that was like.
It was what I would imagine is a fairly unique kind of experience in the realm of film composing, in that it was pretty fun and not a sort of belabored process with lots of people coming in with their two cents. Paul sought me out to do his first movie and kind of left me alone to do it. I mean, had some very clear ideas of what he wanted, and it was a lot of fun, actually. So I've been really lucky in the stuff that I've actually scored, in that I've, you know, I'm so sort of monumentally unambitious. It's like people have to like knock down my door to actually want me to do something. And so with Bob Odenkirk and also this film I did with the Anniversary Party, Jennifer Jason Leigh, mm-hmm. they were just people who kind of knew that my sensibility would be right, and it was, you know, it wasn't.
That was a great film too. I love that film. Yeah, very, very, you know, I mean, low budget, very unusual, but the story was just so, I mean, I imagine composing for it must be interesting, because it probably tugged at different parts of your heart, and you probably related to a lot of that.
I don't know if I related to that much of it, except in, I don't, you know what, I can't remember.
It just gets really deep.
Yeah, it,
it's kind of, you're sitting there, and you're kind of getting kind of edgy,
yeah,
and uncomfortable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which was the attempt,
absolutely.
And it made it such a unique film. So is it a whole different satisfaction? I mean, as a composer, composing for film, and not starting theoretically with your idea, but starting with their idea, looking at what they've put on, you know, on film, and then having to do something to, I never like to say back it up, because I don't believe scoring is backing it up. I believe that it's kind of, to use that big German word, ameliorating the whole process. But is that a whole different kind of buzz and feel for you?
It's a very different experience. In some ways, it's kind of a liberating experience, because it's almost, to me, I kind of look at it, just to draw a stupid analog, I look at it like they've already given me the lyrics, so all I have to do is sort of frame the music part around it. Because I look at the film and the dialogue as sort of the lyric, and then I'm just sort of like finding what works with it and playing with aspects of that just for my own amusement, which may or may not even sort of register with the filmmaker. But there are sort of, sometimes there are rhythmic things in the dialogue that sort of suggest things to me as well. So that's kind of the approach I take.
The whole Largo, I wrote it down as almost like a dialogue question. The whole Largo, Los Angeles, United Musicians thing, you, Amy, Julian, John Bryan, you know, it's kind of like this, I don't want to say new musical mafia, but maybe I do. I mean, what it means to me as somebody who plays music and you know, appreciates music, is it's almost like there's this, and you're going to probably look at me and say you're nuts, but there's this weird kind of quality control there. In that everybody that's involved in it is truly this amazingly talented in different ways, but there's just this amazing group that's kind of, I mean, you haven't really come together, but I mean, you could go and hang and you could just see amazing, amazing things happen, you know? So what? How do you think this all kind of came to be? Was it that Amy just decided to say bye-bye to her record label and you know, and everybody else kind of followed in some way, shape, or form, or what do you think?
Well, I think these are separate chunks of things. I mean, first of all, Largo is really all about this guy Mark Flanagan,
right,
who runs the club, and Mark has sort of had the same kind of MO for this place ever since it opened. And I think he frustrates managers and people who are in the business side of music, because he doesn't deal with any of that. He only deals with artists, and his relationships are always with the performers directly. And he's carved out this niche in Los Angeles, and it's a club where people go and they know that they can expect certain things. They can expect that it's going to be a place where people really listen to music, because Flanagan doesn't tolerate like chatting and industry, you know, sort of scene making and all that kind of stuff. Everybody who plays there sort of understands that it's not really a club. You're basically playing in Mark's living room. I mean, that's the attitude that I take anyway. And Mark is just sort of a guy who has, you know, his own taste in music, his own taste in what's good, and he sort of has this place. So, and it flies in the face of the music industry in a lot of ways. As far as Amy and myself and United Musicians, that's something that came about. I was signed to RCA initially, and when I got out of that deal, they basically held me captive for 4 years, where I wasn't able to make a record and I wasn't able to let go. And when I finally got out of RCA, I was going to I was making a record on my own, and I was going to put it up on the internet, and that's what ultimately became Resigned. And vowed that I wasn't going to get back into the major label thing. And this guy, Brendan O'Brien, who's a wonderful guy and a great producer, was forming a small label on Sony called 57 Records. And Brendan is so anti-corporate and so all about music and cool that I thought, well, all right, I'll give this a try, not thinking that Brendan was going to get screwed. And so that, so I wound up getting locked back into the system again for however many years it was. And Amy was able to get out first out of her deal,
out of
Geffen, put out her record on her label. We decided to form, I started to work on trying to get MP4 back from Epic, which I was not successful in doing. They sort of made overtures like they were going to do it so that it didn't look like they were holding
it. But they didn't support it.
They didn't even release it. They only pressed up like 19,000 copies of the thing.
Oh, wow. So I could sell it on eBay, I suppose. I've got a copy.
They made it so that I could legally sell it out of the back of my car. That's pretty much what they gave me. But anyway, so once I got out, then I formed my own label, and United Musicians is sort of a general sort of co-op of artists who own their copyrights, who don't want to participate in the corporate major label system, and so it's in essence like an artist and art co-op in the sense that Amy and I are both kind of looking for things that we like, where the artists own their masters that we can sort of try to help get some, you know, attention to.
But the great thing also, and it's kind of like the old days of true session musicians, and that you all do play on each other's records to a great extent, and you also, you know, the quotes that you give about the music, it's actually sincere and it's real and it's not some puffed up sort of thing. But you really do, you know, you'll suddenly look at the credits of, you know, any of these records and say, wow, how about that? So, you know, and it's kind of like the old session musician days where there was a group that really respected what the rest of them did and added value to what they did.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a pretty healthy mutual admiration society going on with a lot of the people within all these circles. I mean, at the same time, I'm sure some people can look at it in a negative way and think that the whole scene is very incestuous, but
right.
I don't look at it that way. I think it's like a lot of people who are like-minded in some aspect and you know, are interested in making music for the pleasure and joy of making music.
Yeah, and yet, why do you think that all of you also do, I mean, your songs are very cinematic, so do you think it is natural that almost everybody in your crew, so to speak, also does a lot of composition for film?
No, I don't think that's the reason. I think the reason is because film is now the way people who are outside the system can actually make some money, because the record industry is up and is so chasing their own tail and realizing that they're 10 years behind the curve and they don't know what the hell they're going to do, and maybe the movie industry is going to figure out the answer to digital piracy, which will then retroactively help the music business, but maybe not. And for the time being, one of the best ways to try to actually make money being a composer, being a songwriter, being a musician, is to align yourself in some way with the film industry. It's not, I don't think it's that healthy a thing. It can be great, but it's you know, it just is what it is.
Well, I think the negative part of it is that the average soundtrack album, you know, the ones that the big companies are trying to put out, it's kind of like, it's either the loser tunes from good bands that they figured they better license and give them a chance to make some money on, you know, or it's just all kind of slapped together as kind of a soundtrack in the film where there is no silence and there's just music in every single, you know, frame of the film.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of different, I think, commercial approaches to that and why that is.
But the other thing that's really joyful for me, I just saw Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and I heard, you know, what John did with Beck on that Corgi song. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's got to learn sometime. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard that song before. I finally went and bought the Best of the Corgis. I, you know, it's like there was a hole in my musical knowledge, and it's a pop band that I missed.
Yeah, they're great. I'll give you a tip. The Corgis were actually two of the guys from a great pop band called Stackridge. Mm-hmm. And if you can find the old Stackridge
record, then it's even going to be even better.
Well, that's a great song, mm-hmm. but some of the Stackridge stuff is fantastic.
But when I went back and got the Best of the Corgis, I realized how reverent John and Beck were to the original song. I mean, they were reverent. I mean, it still sounds like a John Bryan piece because the piano is filtered in that John Bryan sort of way and all of that. But so let's move on to the important stuff. So there's a new album. Is there a good disco tune on there? Let's get to the important stuff. Can I dance to it? We need a dance mix. Just need a dance mix. Before I even hear the song, we need a dance mix.
All right, well, I will be sure to put an 808 on everything. See what happens. It's kind of all over the map stylistically, but I never know how to describe my record.
Does it have a name?
Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947.
Okay, and you're going to tell me about that?
I've always been really, really fascinated with the year 1947. I kind of feel, in many ways, like that's the year that the entire world changed. I mean, it's the year that America was the first. The post-World War II era, America was the first nation in history to be in the position to take over the entire globe, but didn't, but really did. I mean, it's a very complicated time. It's the year that the CIA was formed. It's the year that the Pentagon was built. It's the year that the Department of War became the politically double-speaked named Department of Defense. It's the start of the modern UFO phenomenon. It's the year that the transistor was invented. It just goes on and on and on. It's a hugely important year to me. And I was walking through the Rose Bowl swap meet a couple years ago, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw what had to be the most wonderfully bizarre painting I had ever seen. It's a field of gold with three figures in it. The left figure is like a five-year-old boy in a bellhop outfit with a sort of maniacal grin looking off into the heavens. In the middle is a boy, turns out it's the same boy at a different age, in a suit with a banner across his chest that says, Mr. Hollywood Jr., 1947.
That's scary.
And then there's another figure of the same boy that says All-American Boy, 1947. So this painting kind of just coalesced a bunch of stuff in my head, and it's not a concept album by any stretch of the imagination, but the year was kind of in my mind when I wrote all these songs. And so it kind of ties it together.
So what are some of the titles of the songs that kind of came out of that whole thing?
There's a song called Denton Road. There's a song called Walter Reed. There's a song called Pretending. There's a song called Okay. There's a song called A Bad Sign. There's a song called Spit and Thread. I can't remember all of those.
I like Okay.
Yeah, I do too.
I think that's just, you know, that sums it up, doesn't it? Isn't it great when one word, I'll probably hear it tonight, but...
Actually, it's a quiet one, so it kind of depends on the room tonight.
So is this going to be your first time? I mean, have you tried out some of this?
I play once a month at Largo, right, and been doing a lot of the new stuff there acoustically. It's been a while since I've played with a band.
So is tonight a band?
No, it's just me. Although a couple of friends are going to join me. Some people from the Honey Dogs might be able to join me, and a good friend of mine lives here in Austin named Gerf Morlix. He's a wonderful guitarist and producer, and he's going to come up and play some stuff.
So one last question. The whole singer-songwriter thing, I mean, you've been the singer-songwriter. You and a lot of, you know, and Amy and a lot of your gang have been, quote, singer-songwriters for, you know, way before anybody said, you know, the category, right? You know, it's kind of like, well, are you pop? Are you rock? Are you hip-hop? Oh, you're a singer-songwriter. So tell me about that label and how I'm not going to put any words in your mouth. I'll just leave that question right there.
I honestly don't know. I mean, you know.
Are you a singer-songwriter?
Well,
I mean, it's, you know.
I sing and I write songs, so yeah, I guess so. I'm also.
When did bands stop happening, and when did singer songwriters? I mean, you know.
I think the term is more sort of geared toward trying to sort of subdivide music into genres, and I think that's probably something that sort of, to me, when I hear that term as a genre, I think of that sort of period in the early 70s of people like Joni Mitchell and Jackson Browne and that whole sort of mode of people, which to me it's like one of the worst things that ever happened to music, which I think to a large degree happened because of radio formats and the subdivision of music into radio formats. But what I like about rock and roll is that what happened in the course of its development is that eclecticism became the rule, and you could do anything. I mean, if you listen to records of the late 60s, it can be all over the place. It can be a song that sounds like a proto-metal, and then it can suddenly be this acoustic folk song. And it does, and that is sort of the liberating thing about it. So the idea of these sort of subdivisions, I just find kind of annoying. But
so you left New York, Brady. I'm going to try to find a different way to ask this question for once. Yeah. You left New York very early in life, obviously, and made it to the West Coast. So what got into your head musically? Who do you, you know? Did you listen to like KHJ or what got into your head musically that led to this? I think I probably can guess, but
well, as a kid, I listened to KHJ. That was the station that everybody listened to, and KHJ was great. I mean, it was a great AM, you know, pop rock station.
IWABC,
yeah. And it was my very, very early childhood was all the great stuff of the late 60s and early 70s, and then as I got older and was listening to FM stations that played more off the beaten track stuff, I got interested in that, and I just kind of kept being interested in music until some point in like the late 70s when I kind of lost interest in pop music and just got in.
It was kind of a weird time.
Yeah, I mean, punk never really spoke to me in the way that it spoke to a lot of my friends. I mean, I loved The Clash, but I never considered Elvis Costello punk. But a lot of it just didn't really sort of strike me. So I was really interested in a lot of sort of weird stuff, like, you know, German bands like Faust, and you know, people who were doing experimental things, and I got kind of interested in that for a while, and then actually as a result of the interest in sort of more avant-garde stuff, I became friendly with a wonderful songwriter named Peter Blegvad, who I don't know if you're familiar with him, but mm-hmm. Slap Happy was sort of my backdoor back into pop loving music, you know.
So if you were guest DJing and I get the new album, Michael gives it to me, and I can surround you with a couple of tunes, what would you like to play? What would you like to be surrounded by?
I would have to think about that. I mean, to think about like contemporary stuff.
It doesn't have to be contemporary, because it could be anything. What just comes to your head like immediately?
I'm a huge Elliott Smith fan. And mm-hmm. I think we lost an incredibly,
yes, we did,
incredibly talented songwriter. I love listening to Elliott's records. And then maybe from that to something like, there's a wonderful album by a guy named Mark Hollander called, the band that he formed is called Aksak Mabul, mm-hmm. which is all instrumental and just absolutely delightful.
Now that we're alone, trouble baby doesn't always come in threes. I had a hunch the fight was thrown, but what's it gonna take to get me to my knees? It's a bad sign, I'm just marking time. A bad sign, hoping we'll be fine. A bad sign. simple phrase, but all I see are ciphers and a big verse. It's a bad sign, and I'm just marking time. A bad sign, hoping we'll be fine. A bad sign, when I think this way. It's a
Stretches out ahead.
was the script. Everything will turn out fine. Things are looking up. In the meantime, things are looking up. You blew another ring. I thought you'd quit, along with calling misfits. But it's me.
Only Michael Penn, of course, would end a pop tune with something from outer space. It's just something he would do, right? Hour number one of Just Another Menace Sunday. Interview with Michael Penn, done when I was 12 years old. Well, that's what it feels like. South by Southwest a year and a half ago. He didn't do an official musical sandwich because, again, being Michael, he just didn't want to. So we kind of made one up for him. On Automatic, the new single from Mr. Hollywood Jr., 1947. Amy Mann and Michael Penn's soundtrack of I Am Sam, Two of Us. Stackridge, band that turned into the Corgis. I think they turned into, I always get it mixed up, but yeah, they turned into the Corgis. Anyone for Tennis? Aksak Mabul. Good luck finding that one. It was hard for me. Three Epileptic Folk Dances, the late Elliot Smith, Son of Sam, and also from Mr. Hollywood Jr., 1947. You can find that on Spin Art Records, A Bad Sign. It's Just Another Menace Sunday. Your friend, Dennis the Menace. How you doing? How you doing? Don't you like that? Nice New York boy saying, how you doing? Anyway, next week's interview is with The Coral. Their CD, it's just like a trend. Their CD out, oh, some, I don't know, 4 or 5 months after it came out in England. What a darn surprise. And we have a special guest in the studio, which we will get to in mere seconds, right after we do something good.
Do you know what hell is?
Homelessness in San Francisco and across the country is real and growing. The Coalition on Homelessness is a community organization committed to making tangible improvements in the lives of the homeless. Coalition goals combine short-term solutions with long-term strategies to change social and economic justice both locally and nationally. The Coalition on Homelessness welcomes your time, money, and interest, so please contact the Coalition on Homelessness at 346-3740 to find out more.
And thank you, Kathy. I'll get the background music on just for kicks. I'll turn my microphone up, and we'll try to be a professional organization. 90.3 KUSF, Dennis the Menace. It is Just Another Menace Sunday. We have a special guest in the studio. Would you identify yourself, please?
I may. Now, I am David Bash, the founder and CEO of the International Pop Overthrow Festival.
I like CEO. Rock and roll. We've turned to CEOs in rock and roll, as opposed to BTOs.
Yeah, well, Dennis, thank you very much for having me here.
Well, what happened is that I read about the IPO. See, you're the CEO of IPO, but you've probably been told that a million times. And I read about it, and I went after David and said, okay, Power Pop. Who is the Power Pop king of San Francisco? And that probably would be me. And so we're involved in this festival. We've been giving away tickets. We're going to be giving away more, and I wanted to make sure we had David on the Sunday show. Because people can still go. The festival runs, number one, let's talk about the cities that it's already been in this year.
All right, well, it's already been in Nashville, Chicago, and Los Angeles and Liverpool.
Oh, yeah, that place, Liverpool. Yes, that place.
Yeah, we've been there for 3 years, and we've held shows at the world-famous Cavern Club each year, which, of course, is a surreal
experience.
Doesn't
get any cooler than that.
No, it doesn't.
And so San Francisco, but tell me about the festival, because There have been power pop festivals have come and gone, but I mean, number one, do we define it as power pop?
Well, I like to think of the festival as featuring more than just power pop. We've tried to, over the years, we've expanded our boundaries. We have a lot of indie rock and punk rock and folk rock and all different forms of pop music. I mean, power pop will always be first and foremost what we highlight, but you know, we want people to know that there's all kinds of pop music. It's a big spectrum of sounds. Always the emphasis is on hooks and harmony and timeless songwriting. That to be sure is always going to be.
And that's why you're here, because this radio show, you know, we play a little thing we call melodic rock and roll. And people always say, you know, Dennis, what is melodic rock and roll? And I say, let's see. If you can hum it, it's melodic.
And if it's something that stays in your head after the song is over, then sure it's got a good hook. And I know you're about that as well.
Well, yeah, you'll hear actually when we get into the second hour, you'll stay long enough to hear the theme song of this radio show. And you will understand that we understand that concept all too well. So now venues in San Francisco, Sunday night, Monday night, and Tuesday night are the remaining evenings, right? We've been giving away tickets all along on the two radio shows. And they are at...
Sunday night is at the Parkside, and then Monday and Tuesday night will be at Red Devil Lounge.
Two very groovy clubs.
Indeed.
Yes, yes, just small enough to get intimate, just big enough to get sweaty.
There will be lots of sweating, I can assure you.
Exactly. So we're going to hear a few tunes. I think we'll just roll them, because it'll be fun to hear how they all segue together, because it'll give people a good potpourri of, or potpourri, as the case may be.
I like potpourri. You should patent that like Pat Riley did with three-peat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think so. Okay, before I do this, though, I've got to ask you, the impetus for the name of the festival, would that be Material Issue?
To a large degree,
or did they steal it from you?
To a large degree, it would be. Jim Ellison, the founder and singer-songwriter of Material Issue, had tragically taken his own life only a few months before I started the festival. So I just thought it would be a great way to pay tribute both to him and to the kind of music that Material Issue did.
And I was always jealous because I always wanted Valerie to love me.
Well, Valerie.
Because that's what girls want, right?
Yeah, that's true. Material Issue never were shy about dropping girls' names into their songs.
By no stretch. So who are we going to listen to in our little special international pop overthrow set?
Well, I guess we'll start with someone who's playing Sunday night. Michael Guthrie Band. They're actually longtime power poppers. They were around, been around since the early 80s when they released an album called Direct Hits, which has become kind of a lost power pop classic in those circles. And the band is still going strong. They're coming all the way up from Athens, Georgia, which, gee, was there ever another band who came out of Athens?
Georgia.
Let me think about that. They are a great band, and you know, we're glad to have them. They have played, actually, funny, you mentioned Liverpool, Michael Guthrie Band, kind of a second home is the Cavern. They've played there numerous times, including for us. But this is a classic power pop track with just a little mod thrown in, so check it out.
So why don't you be the KUSF DJ, because then you can back announce afterwards and do the official, you know, hi, this is, and you're listening, go ahead.
Hi, this is David Bash, the founder and CEO of the International Pop Overthrow Festival, and you're listening to, what is the name of this station?
Okay, we're going to hit the tune now. That was perfect.
Broad light.
takes me where I want to be. It takes me there where I want to be. What I want to be is free.
You know you're in the right place when the cymbals at the end of a tune go just like that. Just another Menace Sunday. We're almost into hour number two. David Bash is here from the International Pop Overthrow. Why don't you, as we say in the biz, back announce those tunes?
I'll be more than happy to, Dennis. The last track you heard was The Condors, and Condors are led by a gentleman who goes by the name of Pooch, who used to write for Flipside magazine.
I'm sure a lot of
your listeners have heard of that. So unlike being a frustrated journalist who could not become realize his musician dreams, he actually did. And the Condors are just a great power pop band from L.A. And before that, Beyond Veronica, who are from our state's capital, Sacramento, and lead singer Bonnie Veronica has been part of the music scene for a long time as well. Just a great pop tune. And they're going to be playing Tuesday night at Red Devil Lounge, and the Condors are playing tomorrow night at Red Devil Lounge also. So check them out, please.
Did we have a third? Are we all actually, you know, we announced that one already.
Oh, the first one, yeah.
We don't want to double team, you know, because others will feel, you know, like they were, you know, like one got twice the level of publicity, and we just, you know, rock and roll, you don't want to do that. International Pop Overthrow at the Parkside, Red Devil Lounge, tonight, Monday night, and Tuesday night. Hopefully you were smart enough to win some tickets on The Menace's Attic on Friday night. If you weren't, tickets are definitely available, but get there early and see. There are how many bands a night? Five or six?
Usually seven or eight, actually.
Seven or eight. I don't even want to know about the stage movement involved in that.
No, you don't want to know about that.
David, thank you so much. I know you're going to be on the show again, and what we're going to do is have you back on soon to do an hour of nothing but the best power pop in existence.
I would be honored, Dennis.
Which will be great.
Thank you and KUSF for having us.
It's just something to do. Well, it is time for hour number two of Just Another Menace Sunday, this thing we like to call melodic rock and roll with your friend Dennis the Menace. So, Mr. Engineer, it could be Troy, it could be Nate, it could be Zach, it could be the Balloon Man. Would you please hit CD number two right now?